Thank you for joining Swanee TV this evening. We are very lucky to have our ongoing series with Swanee Television, a collaboration with Free City Radio at CKUT. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we have our weekly interviews, which will be just one more month here on Swanee Television. And it's a pleasure to be with you this evening. Tonight, we are joined by Namira Islam Anani, who is an organizer and a graphic designer and also a lawyer in Detroit. Namira is involved in a wide variety of projects. Namira is a social justice specialist for a lot of organizations in the nonprofit sector in Detroit and community groups, and co-founded the Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative, Muslim ARC, in 2014, and is a board member there. Namira is also an associate director at Prolon Inspire. We'll maybe get back to that in a moment. And this is an organization that activates leaders at different levels to accelerate equity at individual, organizational, and systemic levels. And also sits on the Racial Equity Fellowship design team for the Detroit Equity Action Lab, a DEAL. And that's an initiative out of the Damon Keith Center for Civil Rights at Wayne State University's Law School. Namira is a COVID survivor and long hauler, and has, I mean, basically, I got to know a bit about Namira's work in the context of her ongoing work on anti-racism education and faith-based activism and also disability justice. We first connected around the election this fall, but I would just first say that I tried to give some of the bio there. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here and looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you. Thanks again. So I guess maybe a place to start could be where we first had a conversation, which I was interested in speaking with you about some of the challenges that community organizations and activists in, you know, important hubs in the United States, in Detroit, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Phoenix, you know, cities in the Trump years that were in states where it wasn't clear where things would be going because of the election in 2016. There was such an emergency that many communities were facing. Of course, the Muslim community in the weeks after Trump took office faced this violent legislation in terms of the actual legislative banning of travel from a number of Muslim majority countries. There was mass protests, including in Detroit. And there's this wave of activism that I know you were part of in different ways. And I would just be interested in hearing a bit about all of that experience, because maybe at this moment, post-Trump, in the sense of that Trump's not president, people sort of take it for granted that we've gotten to this point. You know, given the US affects the world, I say we. But there was so much struggle and so much organizing and so much energy that went into challenging those policies from the Trump administration, organizing that you were involved in many ways. So I'm just wondering, from your perspective, how important is it for us to actually to take stock and to consider and to understand what a struggle it was to try to overcome a lot of these disastrous policies?
It's a really good question. And as you were even describing, right, like the Trump era, I found myself just really reflecting on the fact that because of how organizing is really addressing things so rapidly sometimes, that I haven't even had the opportunity to fully grapple with what it was to be dealing with that administration, right? For me, I think Muslim ARC, we founded it during the Obama years, right? And at the time, there's this narrative around being in a post-racial America. We elected the first Black president. We're in this new stage when it comes to race. And at the time, I remember an anecdote, kind of a theory that one of my college professors actually was talking about with US presidents. They were saying how it's almost like presidents are elected on a pendulum, that you swing. It's not that you're staying in this middle. You swing left and then you swing back right and you swing back. And so I find myself just really wondering, before Trump was even on the scene, we swung that way, right, to the first Black president. What happens when we swing back? So in many ways, especially with Michigan, the way that people were talking about Michigan and some of these other states was that we're a purple state, right? This idea that it's not blue or red, that you've kind of got this mix of things. And I often found myself really reflecting as I was traveling around the country and working with people in different cities across the country, certain states that are kind of shortcutted as blue states, right? That these always go for Democrats. States like Oregon, for example, oftentimes what happens is that you have a very solid blue kind of high population city surrounded by a lot of red, right? Surrounded by people who typically vote more conservative. And so I think Michigan, in that sense, yes, it's a purple state, but we also see that same thing here, where it's, you've got Detroit, that's very blue, you've got Flint, you've got Lansing, Ann Arbor. This election, Grand Rapids actually went a little bit more blue as well. But, you know, that side of the state, the west side of the state, is oftentimes very red. And so it's very interesting the way that people kind of think about these states. There's also the erasures that happen, you know, talking about the Midwest, the average Midwest voter, which oftentimes is shortcutted as a way to say, you know, a white voter who's out in the Midwest who has, you know, family values, as if other communities don't have that. So as we went from this place of the Obama administration, where we're seeing police brutality, all these deaths, all the kind of protests and the things that are happening, a different kind of style of organizing, to the Trump years. And the way that I often described it, especially to people who might not be, you know, at the front lines or responding or working with people who are on the front lines, it was as if it was like white supremacy on steroids. So it's a system that was working a certain way under a different president. And then with his administration coming in, it was like, oh, the system is designed to work this quickly. It's designed to be able to pass laws as quickly as the Muslim ban was passed, to really shift the immigration policies. It's so easy. It's almost like these progressive winds are like you're clawing at it, right? You're having to do so much. Like, for example, you know, the 1965 Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Acts, these different measures, it's like it took so many people on the streets and it took so much effort to just get a little bit, right? Versus to go the other way, it was so rapid to just be able to put in his own people, to pass this law, to sign this executive order. And that's what I noticed for, you know, my colleagues, especially in Michigan. People often think about immigration as a southern U.S. issue. Michigan is a border state as well, right, bordering with Canada. So you have kind of these measures around jurisdiction for ICE and some of these agencies around immigration. So that's what it felt like. It was just on steroids, rapid developments, trying to mobilize people who have so few resources to address these issues, all happening at one time. So those years are just, the pace has certainly slowed down, but the work is still there, right? And it's still something that is operating in a different way right now.
Well, yeah, and thank you so much for sharing all that, Namira. I was actually really interested in that point, because I think often, you talk about a pendulum in politics. One of the parts of understanding that pendulum, which is very unfortunate that things do, that we do see shifts towards conservative politicians. It seems that one of the pieces in terms of mainstream media discussions around politics, I think this applies both to Canada and the United States, is the ways that community organizers actually push to the left, and the role, like, and so just going back over some of the points that you mentioned around the protests against this racist legislation, as was called the Muslim ban, but also the solidarity that built between Muslim communities, but also my other migrant communities, but also racialized communities. How important is it to make visible all that organizing work that obviously wasn't the Democratic Party?
I love that question because at the end of the day, the victories that we're seeing are not coming from the party. It's not a top down, it's very much a grassroots, bottom up kind of victory. So, and I often say this around, politicians, especially in who we elect, true power is really coming from, regardless of who's in office, community and people having the power to ensure that their will and that their rights are being represented in that politician, regardless of who that politician is, right? And so that's something that I find very important, and especially to uplift kind of the work of organizers on very specific issues, on very specific campaigns, because at the end of the day, this is organizing that's happening regardless of whether it's in the media or not. The organizing for the Muslim ban, I do think that's one kind of difference that I noticed within the Trump administration was that the organizing was lifted a lot more. There was more press coverage. There were more kind of storytelling that was happening that was painting organizers in a very specific light, in a positive light sometimes, right? And showing that these are people who are sacrificing, that are coming together, really uplifting the stories of solidarity across communities. And you're seeing kind of profiles of people who are, in protest, even just more flattering images, right, of like who is in protest. And that's something that is really important because that organizing is always happening. There's, I mean, any issue, there is a group, whether it's funded or unfunded, whether they have media limelight or not, who is pushing for justice on a certain issue. And so that difference is really critical because it did open this window, almost like pulling the curtains back to where it's like, oh yeah, let's cover these airport protests. People are going down to the airports. Let's cover it. Let's make sure that there's round-the-clock coverage, that we're actually featuring these stories. And that work is still happening now, right? And I've already noticed that shift a little bit after this administration came in around just a little bit more muted, right? It's almost like dialing the volume down, even though the work is still happening and the work is still there.
Yeah, could you maybe we could just jump on from that point, like in terms of the importance of continuing to follow and to lift up and to give volume to the organizing that is ongoing, because I mean it's sort of understood that, oh well, given the election in the United States, world power affects everything, politically, economically, that things have changed, but a lot of policies remain on the books, and a lot of organizing continues despite the election. So if there's any examples of particular political points that you think are important that people should continue to look at.
The first thing that came to mind right away was that deportations are still happening. Undocumented immigrants are still being put on planes and being sent out of the country. So I really want to uplift the work of organizers like Patrice Lawrence with Undocu Black, which is based out of DC, Sadie Sarr, who's Senegalese, an activist here in Detroit. So especially thinking about those intersections of immigration impacting not just, Latinx or Latino communities, but also Asian and Black communities as well. Deportations are still happening under this administration. And so that especially gets to the systemic nature of some of this, where I think almost, and I saw this, I was old enough, the first election that I voted in, that I was old enough to vote in, was Barack Obama's first election, right? First campaign. So it was my first presidential election. And I remember just that kind of vibe where people were like, oh, we elected him. We can outsource, right? When it comes to hope and change, we outsource it. You have the reins. We elected you. Our job is done. And that's where you see kind of the lack of engagement out at the local level. You see the lack of engagement for, congressional elections. Anything outside of the presidential election, there's so much money and just the narrative around what a president does, that these issues like immigration, around education, around healthcare, around COVID relief, when it comes to housing bills, as well as just assistance for those who are unemployed, you're seeing some changes here, but especially around the minimum wage, right? So thinking about Fight for 15 and that fight to pass a livable minimum wage, these fights are still needing to happen because just because you elect one person to position of power not only do they not have the power to do that, just to like arbitrarily change all of these things, but there's not always the political will either. And so how are we ensuring that that will that is there is being represented and actually executed in halls of legislative power?
So I would just ask you, Namira, thank you so much for sharing that. What are some memories that you have of protests or sort of moments over these last years where you saw community power being expressed, a community power that you can't see in the presidential seal or, you know, sort of democratic convention? But like you mentioned the airport protests, I know that there was many other moments where people were grappling, especially in Detroit and Michigan more generally, with very serious, violent policies. But in the face of that, people were coming together in many on many occasions with music. I remember hearing that at the Detroit airport, people were singing. There was different community expressions going on. Or any other examples that come to your mind as moments that stay with you?
I think it says a lot about the power of art, right? So even just thinking about some of the really compelling like signs that were seen at protests, but also, yeah, music. I mean, anything from chants at protests to other things. I think one example that came to mind right away, and I think it brings in some of these different layers around, you know, accessibility and the different types of tools that are used for organizing. There was a specific deportation that, you know, a coalition of people that came together was able to stop, halt momentarily at least, where it was notified that somebody was being transferred to the airport to be put on a flight, right, to be deported. And based on that, some of the online organizing that happened where people were tweeting at the airline, people were tweeting to let other people know where to go because there wasn't necessarily information right away to even say which terminal, right, which airline, which flight is even happening. Where do we need to even show up if we're sending people to the airport? And so a lot of that was disseminated online, and a lot of it was through texts and kind of crowdsourcing of information. And then once people got to the airport, there were so many different layers of who was there, right? And you have community leaders, you've got, you know, students, you have movement kind of builders, as well as, you know, local elected representatives, people who were activated to go in person to be there, while also having the people who were maybe physically unable to go because of disability, because of lack of transportation, because they were, you know, at a job that they couldn't leave that way, right? And so you have this coalition with all these different angles, and it was successful at that point to stop that deportation from taking place that day. So something like that, I think, really pulls to mind kind of not only what are the communities that are coming together in terms of ethnicity and in terms of race, but also in terms of disability and ability, as well as, you know, different economic, socioeconomic class, and just thinking about who is really involved when you think about a multiracial, multiethnic, multi-layered kind of coalition.
Thank you so much for sharing all that, Namira. I think just building on that point, often it's sort of, I mean, at this moment now, there's still a misconception of understanding of power. I know that around politics, you practice in various ways as a community organizer. You're also a lawyer and a graphic designer. That's like a lot going on there, respect. In terms of just understanding that the importance of community power, and how does that play out in your different fields of work? You know, having worked more institutionally, I would imagine, or having gone through that process in the legal world, your community work, more also design work, how do you think about that sort of the ways that political power is expressed in different ways and the importance of valuing those different frameworks of political force?
What a great question, because I think, and the older I get, the more pressure that I feel, not from any specific individual, but just from society in general, to pick a lane, right? Where it's just like, okay, either be the graphic designer, be a lawyer, right? Like, And so it is tricky to like manage and balance those things. And I think it is partially tied to this idea of like power and how these tools are so useful in different spaces. I think for me, I mean, one of the reasons I even kind of transitioned, and I was involved with like activism on a college level before even going to law school, but especially in law school, thinking about some of the tools. I mean, the system is designed to have these barriers, right? That lawyers have to speak a certain way, have to understand certain things, have resources to certain materials in order to navigate that system. And so there is such immense power when you have movement lawyers, right? Or people who are considered radical lawyers, radical lawyering, this idea of movement lawyering, where we're being creative with the law and really using it to dismantle some of the things that are happening, and being able to argue certain things. Like, well, if law says this, then what about that, right? But I think that gets into this larger discussion then around like who is passing the laws? Like, what is the power that's there? Do we have concentrated power when it comes to even passing new legislation, right? And so and I'll give an example. Like one of my mentors in law school, my area is human rights education and training. So, and specifically in my last semester of law school, I spent some months researching other countries who have had these histories of genocide and oppression and segregation. What kind of training do they provide future generations, right? Around what are we learning about our history? What are we learning about discrimination and racism? How are we learning about equality and justice, right? And then looking at what the United States has. And the US has very little in terms of what teachers are mandated to teach this next generation so that we never go back, right? And so after doing that research and looking at other countries that have these laws around, okay, you know, curriculum must have this. We have policies around what kids must learn, right? One of my mentors ended up taking that research and then being able to work with a coalition group to pass a bill in the state of Michigan saying that a certain number of hours were then required for kids in public schools to learn about genocide, right? And to really spend that time on that. And then somebody based off of that, they then from another state asked, like, oh, is there any way we could see that legislation, right, to try and pass that a similar bill in our state? But that process was kind of like ad hoc, right? It wasn't like we had a funded organization to do that. Versus when you look at some of the conservative work that's happening, you have a very small group sometimes of lobbyists and people who are writing these bills and then working to get the same bill passed with tweaks and nuances in multiple states. And so that's where you see this like kind of how power is operating with like in the hands of a very few people sometimes. The other thing for me, I was in Flint at Legal Services when the Flint water crisis started, right? And that was an example where it's like, yes, we're using the law to really assist certain clients with certain issues, but at the same time, certain things like hands were tied, right? There were certain things that it's like, oh, we can't address that, or there's no legal remedy that we can provide. It's not clear yet. And so you see these constraints. I think on the other hand, when it comes to art and graphic design, especially, those constraints aren't there, right? Like you can say so much with a picture, with the image, with a point that you're making through art, and just capturing so much. And it's accessible in a different way, especially if you're using like, you know, alt text and to make sure it's accessible for screen readers and all of that. And so really thinking about the ways that art can transcend some of those limitations where you are tightly bound by these constraints. Art can really establish certain things, and it can just really capture people's hearts. One of the things, and I'll end on this for really thinking about this dynamic, especially around the community organizing, especially, is anti-racism work sometimes really focuses on like the headspace analysis a lot, where we're really spending a lot of time in just like intellectual analysis and questions, and you know, what about this? What about that? But a lot of anti-racism work is really about the heart space work too. So that aspect of the heart work, how are we telling stories that are connecting to people's emotions, to really thinking about how this is having an impact on people's bodies and souls, right? That work is not necessarily always happening. And I think art, especially with design and narrative shifts, address a lot more of that. And a good community organizer will be able to use both, right? And so really be able to craft this strategy. And be able to bring in people's whole selves and not just always focusing on statistics and figures, right? But actually on the real people who are involved.
And I really appreciate this. You mentioned narrative shifts, and I'm noticing a shift in terms of just underlining a few things that you were just saying, Namira, about narrative shifts in the sense of I'm seeing much more value being given, and I know that it's not officialized at this point, but towards the community organizing that you're talking about, or you talked about this law that was instituted in the context of Michigan around recognizing and understanding genocide and the importance of actually breaking that down within an educational system, a public educational system. But that law didn't happen in a vacuum. There's been many communities talking about these struggles to have a recognition. Whether I mean and on the violence of state power for many generations now, but there does seem to be a narrative shift happening around there is a recognition of the role of community power more and more. I'm wondering if you've seen that and how that relates to your work. And I would just say there that I mean it's pretty clear that the only reason Trump was voted out was because community power stood up in a number of key cities, including Detroit.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's why it's been so interesting watching the shift on Twitter specifically, because when Muslim Arc started, we started out on Twitter, right? We launched with the hashtag being Black and Muslim. It was during Black History Month. It went viral, was trending globally in 7.5 hours. And I really think, this difference of crowdsourcing online and being able to have a space where you are hearing directly from people who are impacted, and then you're able to connect with other people who are directly impacted. You're able to pool all the resources that are there. You're able to say, hey, we really could use a graphic designer, right? Is somebody available? And just being able to have that connection and the method for it. I do think that's why we're seeing all these shifts that have been happening through social media to either restrict or to filter what shows up, right? And how it shows up on people's timelines. And also just the different kind of levels of structural targeting that's happened through social media to kind of curb that influence. I think that's a really powerful tool. And I want to say that ultimately with that narrative shift, I think this is why. Because when it comes to especially anti-racism education piece, some of it is malicious, that you have certain people who are absolutely malicious, and when they're suppressing certain voices, when they're intentionally choosing to limit certain narratives, right, and to push back against certain narratives. There's absolutely a malicious intent that is there where people are using that power and using their influence to do that. I think there also is just kind of like the ignorance that comes up too from people who maybe don't know better. And that's where this education lens is really important because at the end of the day, all of us have different layers to our identities. And for many of us, if we have privilege in a certain area of identity, and this comes up a lot with like disability, right? If I'm somebody who does not use a wheelchair and is not worrying about access into a building, I might not think about it. So am I that aware of, the narratives and the stories that need to come out of that space that I need to be amplifying? And so I often give people that kind of reminder, right, where it's like sometimes it is malicious that somebody's intentionally, they've been taught, they've been given opportunities to adjust and to do something differently, and they don't. Other people, though, I think with Twitter, that's been something that has happened where people are like, wait a second, this person's right. Like, I need to be doing this differently. This article is not accurate. This narrative is problematic, right? This show is problematic. And so this comes up a lot right now around people, railing against cancel culture. But the reality is when you're looking back, at a book that was published 10 years ago, it's not that somehow 10 years ago that was acceptable. Is that the voices that were being amplified at the time did not have access to talk about how harmful something was, right? And right now that access has been amplified, different platforms have been created, and other people are seeing the values of these things and also amplifying it. So you have that kind of larger base of people who are working together, and that's where that community power really is to amplify and tell these stories and shift the narratives to where it's like, this was never acceptable, right? It wasn't acceptable in the 90s. It's not acceptable now. Why do we still have it, right? Like, why not make a change? And so I think that's where the narrative shifts are happening, is a lot of it's coming from the people power that's happening.
Oh, well, Hi, everybody. It seems like we've lost our guest just for a moment. We'll be back. This is Swoney TV. We'll be back in a moment. Do stay tuned. Thank you for being with us.
Okay, am I back? Sorry about that.
Okay, we are
Speak
back. Okay,
the tools,
great.
right?
Hey, great. You were talking about the sort of the ways that narrative shifts are happening in terms of people having access to challenge. Please go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think with social media tools right now, that's been something that I think has really led to the shift, where you're hearing directly from people, you're getting to read all these different viewpoints. And I think the fact that so many different voices are talking about the same thing is really helping people just understand. They're getting more exposure to some of these topics that sometimes you might only find in a classroom or an academic setting, right? That you're in certain spaces where the learning is happening, but then on social media, you're like, oh, here's a link to something, right? Here's a reading list. Here's somebody who's talking about this on a regular basis. And I'm able to curate the feed that I have. I'm able to actually have more of these voices who are saying similar things, explaining certain things, and I'm able to learn and change my behavior in real time. And so, I mean, today I was watching a video of like a compilation of TikToks, right? Where it was an indigenous, Native American organizer who was just talking and deconstructing some of these things. And it's very quick, right? It's like within a minute and a half, talking about cultural appropriation. What is the difference between cultural appropriation and cultural appreciation, right? What are some things that are problematic that maybe you shouldn't say? And so the fact that you're seeing popular community education happening this way and that people are able to access it, I think says a lot about where and how these narratives are then shifting.
We're joined by Namira Islam Anani, who is a lawyer, community organizer, graphic designer, and many other things based in Detroit. You mentioned a campaign that I do remember when that launched, which was a campaign of solidarity in terms of struggling against racism targeting, systemic racism targeting the Muslim community, but also making that choice to be in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. Could you talk a bit about that campaign and how it went down and the organizing that you did around that?
So, being Black and Muslim at the time, this was after Ferguson, after Trayvon Martin, right? And there were these conversations that were happening on social media that year. There were a number of kind of, Muslim hashtags that kind of went viral without much, fanfare. It was something that was very organic that was happening at the time. And a number of people had been talking about just, anti-racism, anti-Blackness within Muslim spaces. What does that look like? Black Muslim identity, right? Just being able to think about both the marginalization that happens, but then also like the joyous parts of it, right? And what that culture looks like and the different aspects of culture for Black Muslim identity. And so, based on a few different people who were kind of talking about like maybe we should have a hashtag, maybe we should do something kind of collectively about this. At the time, I had just graduated from law school and passed the bar exam. And I remember being like, you know what? I've got some time. Let me get your emails. Let's put you together in a group. Do you guys really want to do a hashtag, right? So let's talk about it. Like, what should the hashtag be? When should we have it? Who's going to be involved? What is it going to look like? And so that kind of kickoff email is what led eventually to the formation of Muslim ARC, especially once I was connected with Marguerite Hill, our current executive director, who is an educator and was saying, like, hashtag's great, but what if we had more, right? What if we had more education that was happening around anti-Blackness in Muslim spaces? And so really it was being Black and Muslim was a celebration of Black Muslim experience, right? And a way to just share these experiences in a collective manner through something like a Twitter hashtag. So we launched the hashtag, and then within 7.5 hours, it was global, right? Where a number of people were talking about the Black Muslim experience and Black Muslim experiences, right? Because of the diversity within that space. both things that they're experiencing in terms of racism within Muslim spaces, things that they're experiencing in larger just American society globally. And the thing that really struck me and many other people was the reality that, like, regardless of where somebody was chatting from, where they were tweeting from, whether it's rural location, whether it's, you know, city environment, suburban, whatever location they were in, there were so many similarities. And that just really went to demonstrate how these things are patterns of behavior. It's not something that is just highly individual. Oh, you had one bad experience at one mosque. When you're hearing from hundreds of voices talking about the similar experiences happening in, you know, masajid all across the country and then all across the world sometimes, right? You're seeing these patterns where it's like, oh, what is going on? Like, how do we then unpack this? Where is this coming from? What interventions need to happen? And what does this mean for, you know, anti-racism organizing as a whole? Where are American Muslims? Where are Muslims in the world when it comes to challenging white supremacy? And how is this system then impacting different communities? So it really led to this kickoff for Muslim Arc's work around community education, but then also, you know, even looking at Islamophobia from a critical anti-Islamophobia lens. So the workshops and trainings that Muslim Arc provides are really getting to deal with these nuances and complexities of these relationships, especially in communities of color. So not just looking at it from a white versus black kind of lens, but looking at it from, you know, the richness of the diversity of the entire experience. And especially when you're in a Muslim space where, you know, a white person is not white, there's not a white majority, what do those dynamics look like and where is that coming from? And then how do you then do community work? How do you do healing? How do you do bridging? How do you then build together, given that the system is impacting us all in different ways?
Namira, thanks for sharing all that. One point that we had a chance to talk about once, which I think in another interview we did for CKUT radio, was the importance of also understanding racism and systemic racism towards Muslim people in the United States as something that is not necessarily tied to a context of contemporary immigration, but that's something that is linked to history, all the way back to colonization and slavery. Thinking about the Muslim African communities that were impacted by the transatlantic slave trade, I know that this is something that more people are starting to address. But yeah, I'm wondering if you could share at all about thinking about systemic racism and towards Muslim people in the United States actually as being quite foundational to some of the colonial orientations of the US government.
That's a great way to sum it up. I think just looking at the Americas as a whole, right, even before the founding of the United States, and then this goes back to that power of narrative, because what happened where, especially nowadays, as we're getting to this place where, you know, 9/11 was 20 years ago,
Wow, yeah.
just really recognizing how much time has shifted, it's like that narrative when you have this narrative created around like Islamophobia started at 9/11, right?
Yeah.
That narrative around Islamophobia and anti-Muslim bigotry, you know, that's a really fixed starting point. It's like that's a very important point, but it is not the starting point. And it goes back to, again, like education and the lack of awareness sometimes about these things, but also sometimes very targeted efforts to suppress these narratives out of whatever intentions that people have. But the reality is, like, you know, up to a third of all enslaved Africans brought to the United States were Muslim. And even when you're looking back at some of the writings and the different documentation that existed at the time, there is mention and antagonism toward Muslims, specifically tied to Muslim identity, especially in that context of the slave trade. And so you have, you know, kings in Europe talking about, oh, you know, enslaved Africans who are in the Americas who are Muslim know how to read and write. And they're able to gather in a different way, and they are sometimes part of these coalitions that are fomenting rebellion, right? And so you have documentation of, you know, one of the European kings being like, "Don't send Muslims there; they cause trouble," right? And so you're seeing this kind of rhetoric that's happening, and then definitely looking back at something like the Crusades and Orientalism and how that narrative was constructed around Muslims being a threat to European civilization. And then when you have the United States of America being founded with this mythicism around, oh, this is, a Christian nation. This is a nation that is white, right? This is a nation that is very much couched in what it is not, which is it is not indigenous, it is not Native American, it is not Black, it is not African, it is white. And so as we're constructing this narrative around it, that's where so much of this, building in of anti-Muslim kind of bigotry comes in, Orientalism comes in, the genocide of Native Americans, and the rhetoric around anti-Indigenous policy as well as anti, Black policy. So much of it is bundled together in order to even justify colonialism, in order to justify genocide, in order to justify enslavement. And then as we're going through, imperialism throughout the world, it's like, well, these Muslims don't know how to govern themselves. These Muslims are backwards. These Muslims need help. They need us to come in and save their women, right? Like all these narratives that have existed before 9/11 have been used to justify policy, have been used to justify greed and expansion, right? And so this is just something that you can trace it back so far. And I think there's a hesitancy to do that, but in order to really unpack white supremacy, which is the direct threat, that needs to happen. These connections need to be made, and we need to be able to embrace how horrifying it can be, but also recognizing the ways that these systems are impacting so many different lives in so many unique ways sometimes.
Well, also, like a lot of the sort of narrative around historical narratives around the context of colonization in the Americas, in terms of the capacities of Western European countries to actually go through with colonization and these actions of profound violence. Just in terms of like concepts of intergenerational wealth, but also just in terms of the mechanisms of like even the capacity after the Middle Ages that actually a lot of these the science that was used for terrible purposes, but the science of shipbuilding and the science of navigation, a lot of them these capacities did actually come from the House of Wisdom in Baghdad and the context of Islamic learning that also is often so often cut out.
It goes back to the idea of, the Dark Ages. And it's like, okay, but the Dark Ages were where, right? And what was happening in the rest of the world? And so even the ways that these narratives about, centuries past and what was happening, it's like centering around Europe, centering on what was happening. I like to give the example sometimes in spaces around, what were women's rights in Europe at the time that, Islam was really talking about women's rights, right? Women's rights, women were considered property at the time in Europe. And so just really thinking about how that's just seen as kind of this default narrative, like, oh yeah, in the world, everywhere, women were just considered property up until this year, right? Up until this specific decade, up until this specific movement. And so it goes back to how this operates, where you have these narratives and these experiences around, white European experiences that are seen as the default. They're seen as the norm. This is how the entire world was. This is how everybody was thinking. And that's not true. And there's a lot that goes into preserving that myth. And I think there's something to be said around, the way that power operates, kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, too. It's like in the United States, in particular, when you have non-Black immigrant Muslims, right, who are coming from these other countries, really being able to have these Muslims endorse the narrative that, like, oh yeah, America is a nation of immigrants, right? We're all immigrants. That's something that so many people uncritically say. And it's said as a way to kind of, gain acceptance or to have like a shared narrative with white people in the space. But at the end of the day, what does that narrative do, right? It erases the fact that early colonizers were not immigrants. They were invaders. They came here by force. They were not welcome here. There was no system of immigration that they were able to get visas, right? Like, and so that erases that. It erases the fact that some people were forcibly brought here. That enslaved Africans did not have a choice to migrate here, right? And so even just seeing how power is structured around that, where you have so many people uncritically repeat that, people of color, right? We're a nation of immigrants. You know, I'm an immigrant. I believe in the American dream. I was able to accomplish the American dream. And then you're seeing how things are really doubled down and how these systems are operating.
Namira Islam Anani is joining us from Detroit. This is Free City Radio's interview series on SWOWNY TV. Thanks for being with us tonight, Namira. We have about 10 more minutes. So thanks again. Maybe if you could talk a bit about and thanks for sharing all your reflections on this history and unpacking this these points so important. What are you up to these days in terms of I know all this stuff informs the organizing that you're doing. Often I admire what you're doing because you're taking a lot of this and translating it into day-to-day organizing, right? So how's that going and what are some projects that you're working on that you might want to share with us?
It's I've been doing a lot of reflecting. I think especially surviving COVID last year, it really brought a lot to the forefront for me to just think about, like, what do I really enjoy doing? Right? Where do I need to be? What are some of the things that I really feel a sense of, urgency around, as well as that there's a strength here that I can really adopt. And so I think that's something that over, these last 10 years, especially of being in community, of doing different types of organizing, of crowdfunding money, right? Of thinking about these legal implications and doing this broader lens around human rights education and training. There's been a couple of different things that I've really absorbed, which one, it's the reality that like one person should not be doing everything. We should be really embracing the fact that people are highly specializing, right, in different areas of work. And so people who are doing the get out the vote and voter registration and all the voting kind of work, that's awesome. Do that work. Other people are doing, more advocacy and policy work, great. Other people who are community building and making sure that, different directly impacted communities have what they need. We should be specializing. And so kind of where I've landed is recognizing the ways that this education really is needed around healing, and especially around development of leadership potential for individuals. And so that's where I've kind of found myself right now. And part of that is through, the Detroit Equity Action Lab. I was a DEAL 3 fellow. We're currently in the sixth cohort. And I've been on the design team for 3 years now. And it's recognizing the ways that people who are directly impacted are often being asked to respond and to build and to organize around issues without really given many resources, right? They are not given not just the funds to do the work, but also just the resources that people need to be able to heal and grow when it comes to trauma. We're dealing with a lot. And so sometimes things are internalized. We don't always have the healthiest coping mechanisms. We don't have the resources to even conceptualize what it is we're doing. We're just thrown in it. And so that really makes a huge difference. I know for myself, it's made a big difference to be able to get that coaching, that mentorship, but also just that kind of guidance around, like, here's how to really be able to not let white supremacy dictate what it is you're doing. We're certainly organizing against something like white supremacy, but at the end of the day, like, this work takes so much from people. And sometimes it's what we're asking of community leaders, especially, is to be the martyr, that we're always outsourcing work to people that they just should not have a life, right? That's their, if it means even laying down their life, that's what they should be doing. That's what the work looks like. And the reality is, like, strong people don't need a strong leader. And that Ella Baker quote has really stuck with me a lot, because it's like, how are we building strong people? And especially when people are impacted by so much, how are we investing in them and letting them then invest in their kind of communities and their organizations and the work that they're doing? So many people are not in alignment with what their strengths are and what their expertise lies in, and they're just kind of like doing things because they're being called to do it, rather than having that passion and be able to disrupt some of these behaviors in their own lives, right? We should be able to rest We should be able to have joy. We should be able to do this work while also living. Living well, especially in a system that is targeting you, is a form of resistance. That is revolutionary. And so, how are we doing that? And how are we ensuring that we're teaching these skills, that we're building resilience practices amongst our own, right? And so, that's kind of where I've landed. So, I'm currently, on the design team for the Detroit Equity Action Lab. I actually just this past month started as associate director at ProInspire, which is an organization that is really looking at, accelerating leadership by investing in equity, thinking about organizational change. Right? How are we disrupting some of these systems and teaching new tools? Because this stuff is not just gleaned by osmosis, right? That you hear something or you read it and you're able to just suddenly implement it. We need coaches and we need instructors and people who are able to crowdsource that information together and to be on this journey together. And so those are just some of the areas, with Melissa Mark's work, I'm really proud of just the way that the organization, transitioning into the board. I'm really excited about the new AML fellowship program where we're training new trainers and being able to continue some of this really powerful community education piece. So right now that's kind of where I'm finding myself is really investing in individuals and seeing that changes on that very highly personal level.
You mentioned, Namira, thanks for sharing all that about what you're where you're at right now. You mentioned, sort of this, and it maybe there's a link to some of the other points we were talking about, just in terms of surviving like those Trump years, and then you talked about surviving COVID respect. But getting to this point where, okay, so you've survived. One has survived, a community has survived. Some people did not survive, a lot of people. But getting to that point, then to build, right? Like there's surviving, healing, and then building. It's there's a lot there. I think often, I guess, we don't have that much more time, but I really appreciate your reflections. But often that whole process of organizing and the nurturing that is so important to community spaces and community organizing and the healing that is part of that is often removed even from like media narratives that might be sympathetic, but they sort of often fall into that sort of martyr sort of like jam where they're just like, okay, well, they don't aren't talking about all that stuff that's happening in between.
And I think it goes to the way that people respond to something like white supremacy is oftentimes by trying to just like counter it with a one-to-one, right? So if, for example, if somebody makes a stereotype that Muslim women are oppressed, then instead of us really analyzing and deconstructing the stereotype, we just kind of respond with a one-to-one, right? And we just say like, no, Muslim women are not oppressed, right? Here are all the ways we're not oppressed. And that's kind of where we focus instead of asking like, who are you to be even saying that Muslim women are oppressed? What does oppression look like, right? Like, it's just a one-to-one response. And so with white supremacy, that's oftentimes what happens is that people are like, oh, in order to deconstruct white supremacy, we have to like match it with a more diverse form of leadership. That kind of just looks like white supremacy sometimes, but just has more diversity in it. And it's a matching of one to one, when the reality is this kind of work is about creating new ways of being with one another, disrupting existing systems of oppression. But we're not going to just, we don't have the luxury of only doing that once we dismantle oppression. That's where sometimes I see people kind of getting stuck, where it's like, oh, once we get to this place where things are better, where we're not dealing with some of these systemic injustices, then we can rest. Then we can apologize to one another. Then we can focus on relationship building. Then we can be, thinking about the environment or about health or whatever, right? It's kind of this dichotomy that's like, well, we gotta hustle now, and that's how when we're gonna get there. But the reality is like, that's where that revolution is starting that disruption now. This work preceded us by generations, it is going to continue after us by generations. So how are we creating new ways of being with one another that really honor each person, that really think about coming on this journey together, about what people need and matching and meeting those needs, right? How can we not just survive but thrive? And that specific work is the work. And I really, have been so grateful to be in a community of people who recognize that and are choosing to live out revolution just in their everyday lives, right, as to how we're approaching the work. And so that's, I think, a connection because it's like we're here because people did thrive and that they had resiliency practices. And for the people who were not able to survive, right, is that what they would want for us to be suffering the ways that they suffered, right? And so how are we really disrupting that system of suffering? How are we creating more resilience and care and love for each other in a system in a world that does not want that for us?
Namira Islam Anani in Detroit, who works with Detroit Equity Action Lab, and the Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative Muslim Arc. Where could people go if they wanted to learn more about any of the groups that you're working with?
People are welcome to follow us on social media and to check out the different websites. So the Detroit Equity Action Lab is on Twitter and Facebook. ProInspire is on Facebook and Twitter. And then Muslim Arc is on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So MuslimARC.org, ProInspire.org, and the Detroit Equity Action Lab is DEAL on Google. You're also welcome to find me online through Twitter and Instagram, especially, and at NamiraAnani.com. And there are links to all of these different amazing kind of community-based organizations there.
Great. Well, we're able to visit a bunch of topics tonight. Thank you for taking the time to speak on Swoni TV, Namira, and for your generous sharing here. I really appreciate you being here tonight, and thank you again.
Thank you so much. The time just flies whenever we speak. So I really, really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure. Thank you. This has been Swoni TV here. I'm your host, Stefan.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2 meter distance from others, wearing a mask, and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips, and if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
And gentle to each other. To give your best when it's asked of you. To do what you have to do when you're supposed to. You've got to feel it. You've got to feel the soul down inside of you. To be clean, you've got to make it straight. You can't be lean. To share the joys togetherness can bring. To the true soul, you just have to cling, and then you will feel it, feel it, feel. You feel the soul inside of you. You've got to feel it.
Sandra Boza, a voice of power and passion, songs that touch your heart and fuel your soul. Winner of the Toronto Blues Society Talent Search, Sandra Boza is an R&B, soul, and Americana singer-songwriter. Her latest release, Falling Away From Me, is filled with deep grooves that reveal her sultry and soulful vocals. Catch a live online concert with high-definition sound and videography coming April 10th. Tickets and info available now at sandraboza.com. SandraBouza.com.